Hi, this is Nick Bowers from Jorgensen Bowers, and you are listening to the Real Talk Podcast.
And welcome to another episode of the Real Talk Podcast. As always, thank you for our listeners, our loyal followers, on episode 101. Can you believe it? We just did episode 100 to shout out all of our last guests, including some of our favorites. Some of our favorites includes, actually, today's guest partner, Andrew Jorgis, or Andrew Jorgis. Or Jorges, however you would like to pronounce it. Today's guest is a special guest. We're hot into 2024, and actually, he is our first individual guest in 2024. Nick Bowers. Pleased to have Nick on the show. Nick and I actually met probably 7 or 8 years ago at a closing table at your office in, I believe it was near Penn Station, somewhere in that vicinity. The reason why I wanted Nick on the show today, we had an opportunity to work on several deals together, including a few that were estate related. And Nick is an estate specialist in the state of New York, and we have a lot of questions that we'd like to discuss. And I believe this would be great training for not just the casual real estate consumer or listener, but also for real estate agents that are in the business, just not in the state of New York, but perhaps in the national level. Nick is a lifelong New Yorker, born and raised in Manhattan, grew up in the Flatiron / Chelsea area, where we are actually recording today. We'll get to know more about Nick shortly. To give you a general background, Nick did his undergraduate in BU, law school at Pace, and currently runs an office of lawyers with his new partner, Andrew Jorgis, which is going to be a breaking news. The website's still coming soon.
Sure.
Breaking soon situation. Andrew, as you may know, if you follow my stories on Instagram or if you follow our work, we work closely with Andrew, and also he is a very good friend of the podcast. Nick, just in short, has glowing reviews online, which I'll share a few excerpts from. Kevin G on Yelp writes, "I rarely have an experience with a lawyer that is positive. I always get stuck with a bill that is unexpectedly high or getting shuffled between less experienced lawyers." I can also confirm this with other law firms. That said, working with Nick has been awesome. He is thoughtful and thorough. He takes ownership for his work and follows the steps and details of the transaction closely. One more that I thought was interesting, Dan P. writes, "Nick made me feel like I was the only client, although I know I wasn't, with remarkably quick and accurate responses. I've done 19 real estate transactions with Nick. Nick is head and shoulders above rest of the managing classes. I would recommend Nick to anyone. Many thanks, Nick." So with that, Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the show.
I don't know if I can live up to that.
I don't know if you're paying people the right.
I'm not.
The first guy sounded like a Grinch, but he was like, "Nick is the best. I always give negative reviews, except for Nick."
Yeah, so. I just closed the deal for him. It was a tough one. He was completely remote, but he came back to me, and we had tough walkthrough issues, but I got it done.
That's good. So for those listeners, you know, Nick does closings as well, although mainly want to really talk about your estate and business. But before we get too deep into who you are, what you do, I am going to start off, as we do with all of our guests, the section called One Word Answers. Please answer the following phrases or words or sentences that I'm about to say and answer them in one word. Game show music is on. First word is 421A tax abatement.
Good.
Number two, rent stabilization and rent control in New York City.
Changing a lot.
Rental laws in New York City.
Very tenant favored.
Local law, 11.
Painful.
Real estate, reality, television.
Fake as fake can be.
Call boards.
Difficult, but necessary.
New York State estate law.
Stricter than some states, but better than some other states.
New York State marital law.
Fairly balanced.
Co-op and condo managing agents.
The bane of my existence.
Affordable housing.
A good thing.
Mayor Eric Adams.
Overwhelmed.
Work from home policy.
Hate it.
Gen Z.
Like Gen X better.
Co-op boards and estate law.
A lot of billable time.
New York probate process.
Slow but necessary.
I want to go over a few of these answers that he said. I got to say, thank you for supporting the truth about reality television as us agents. It's giving our industry a very bad look. I'm sure if you guys had a reality television on lawyers, it would also be shown in a way that is not anywhere close to reality. So I appreciate that answer. But more importantly, let's talk about billable hours for managing agents or co-op boards. And co-op boards in a state law, that is. Maybe just give me a 1 minute response to why you said that.
Co-op boards in particular, they have a lot of responsibility due to the fact that the tax bill for the building is being paid by the co-op. Most of the times the co-op has an underlying mortgage. So they have a lot of responsibility to collect money. So when you seek to do kind of sophisticated estate planning measures, like putting a co-op in a trust, you're adding an extra layer that protects the unit owner from a creditor like the co-op. If the co-op didn't do anything and didn't have lots of legal documents in place, the co-op would be at a big disadvantage. So in order to have them, there is this fair balance where there's a number of additional agreements in place that you normally wouldn't have. It's a lot of legal time.
A 421A tax abatement program. You, as a lifelong New Yorker, you've seen the shape of the skyline change dramatically, especially in areas like Hudson Yards, Williamsburg, Dumbo, Queens, Long Island. You said it's a good thing for the program to exist. It does not exist today. What are your thoughts in the future? What should a city do with a program like 421A or the other various types of programs that they're trying to implement right now to pass through legislation?
So my particular opinion is that 421A should be brought back. If you look at the policy behind it, it's taking underdeveloped land, underutilized land, and it's turning that land into something that's ultimately going to be very high tax producing. At the same time, it's creating a beautiful luxury building in a space, making the landscape of the city more attractive. So it's a win-win. I mean, yes, there's a shelter from property taxes for a period of year, but in the scheme of things, that's a short-term loss for a big long-term benefit. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big proponent and fan of it, and I think they should bring it back.
I feel like a lot of local New Yorkers, quote-unquote, right, lifelong New Yorkers born and bred in the Upper East Side or born and bred in the maybe the Upper West Side too, because their landmark, their view of change is foreign, and they are bigger proponents of keeping things as is and fighting the system. We want everything to stay the same. As someone that grew up downtown and perhaps not in a landmarked neighborhood, you and your family may be more proponents of development. What are your thoughts on New Yorkers as a whole seems to be anti-change, and why do you think that is?
People get nostalgic. Just to give you an example, the block I grew up on, 17th between 6th and 7th, grew up in a loft that was above a carpet store called Ironson's. There's a thrift store next door called Housing Works. So those still exist, right?
It does.
Yeah. But when I grew up there, it was Barty's across the street, a famous clothing wear store. And then that block is completely transformed. So beautiful condo, parking lot, developments. And in my opinion is that it was heading downwards when I lived there. A lot of graffiti, a lot of crime when I grew up in the 80s, 70s and 80s. And so
hard to imagine that right now here, huh?
Hard to imagine.
Crime and graffiti.
Yeah.
On 16th, 17th Street between 6th and 7th Avenue.
Yeah. Got mugged on the 17th Street. I got a gun to my head. So it was a much different place in the 70s and 80s. But that change, like, I look at it from an economic standpoint. You know, a lot of money's flowing around from around the world to come here. There's a lot of professionals like me, real estate brokers. It creates a lot of jobs, creates a lot of opportunity. I want that money to come in. And that all happens when you invest in the city. And new developments are just part of that. Now, some of the new developments, people might say, oh, but they're getting rid of affordable housing. A lot of the 421As, a component of getting that is to create a section of that that's for affordable housing.
Yeah.
So they deal with that as even part of it. Yeah. So that's the biggest negative, and there's protections on that.
Change is a difficult thing for people to realize. I think one of the reasons why 421A died, or maybe one of several reasons, is the locals' drive to not have things change, and they want what was in the old New York to continue to stay in that regard. I'm thinking there's also a similar group of people that hate 421A because they think landlords are evil. And I think that also coincides with some of the new rental legislation laws that were passed in 2019, August, where stabilized properties must stay stabilized for the forever term, not when the individual dies or they move out. They continue to stay stabilized. It takes 1 to 2 years for landlords to evict tenants, even if there is a good cause for eviction. Not an evil cause, but no non-payment of rent, or harassment, or criminal activity, or so forth. That group that views landlords as evil is also propelling the anti-real estate development group. You know, if landlords are evil, of course developers are even more evil. They're the worst guys. I think that view needs to potentially shift if we need to move into the future. Just like you said with 421A, it does give an area like Williamsburg back in the day, it gives developers an opportunity to build on undeveloped land that is underutilized to make better for the community. I mean, look how beautiful the neighborhood is today. I mean, did you ever go to Williamsburg in the 90s?
No. I mean, Brooklyn was like a foreign country. Like, we joked a lot.
What was Dumbo and Williamsburg like in the 60s,
It was very industrial, very empty. It was very commercial.
Yeah.
And people that were investing there, I thought they were crazy. I thought it was like insane that people were spending $100,000 for an entire building there.
$100,000 for an entire building.
Yeah. The apartments on 17th Street, the early ones were $10,000 for a full floor loft on 17th between 6th and 7th. So if you held on to that today, that's like 1,000% return on your investment.
Yeah.
So same, yeah, it was a totally different landscape. Even Brooklyn in general, which is where I live now, is nothing. I mean, I live in Park Slope, which is pretty bougie.
Now it is.
You know, back in the day, it certainly was.
Back when you were a kid growing up, getting mugged in Flatiron,
that's not going
to Brooklyn.
Yeah. That's right. Okay.
So short form answers, I just want to take a couple minutes here to just let the audience get to know who you are, your personal side of Nick Bowers. So first question for you is, you're from New York City. What areas of Park Slope do you currently reside in?
So I currently have a house on the border of Park Slope and Windsor Terrace, right off of Prospect Park West. Mm-hmm. So Prospect Park is not too far away. So for me, I would have loved to stay in Manhattan, but I have two kids and a wife and a dog, and you add that all together, and a house in Brooklyn for the same price, three bedroom, sounds nice.
Okay. So you're all about New York City and the boroughs. What is your favorite city or state outside of New York City, and why?
So I'd love to chop up New York City and drag it down south. I would like to be in eternal summer if I had my choice.
Chop up New York, bring it down to Florida?
Yes, yeah, that's what I'd like to do.
So it's basically Miami.
Exactly. So I'd like to chain link New York City to Miami.
Okay.
Because I like the, Miami has the fun nightlife, it's got the warm weather.
Got the pro-business laws, maybe?
Got the pro-business laws and great estate tax stuff.
Okay.
New York has an estate tax and an amount over which you pay a dollar. Florida has a lot of snowbirds go down there because it has more favorable treatment on that kind of stuff.
So if you're, let's just say, elderly, one of the reasons why they fly down there is not just the weather.
Not just the weather. That's right.
Favorable tax laws.
Exactly.
From a state standpoint. Do you have a social media platform? Do you ever go on social media at all?
Yeah. So I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat.
Snapchat. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I've got kids. So
Do you allow your kids to go on social media?
My almost 13-year-old, yes. My 9.5-year-old, I wish not as much. They're better at social media. My law partner, Andrew, is very good at social media and branding and all that. I'm aiming to get better at that, but I'm more of a stalker than a user.
Sure. You're a peruser.
A peruser is a better word. You're a stalker. I'm not a stalker. I'm a stalker.
So you're a lifelong New Yorker. I want to know your recently favorite New York City restaurants or establishments. We have two of them. And then after that, please tell me your all-time go-to, which obviously probably a very easy answer for you.
Okay. Actually, pretty tough for me because they've changed over time. So I was thinking about this on my way over here, especially because we're in this neighborhood. It's a waiter in the 1990s for this restaurant on 13th between 6th and 7th. I haven't been there in about 6 months, but I assume it's still around. It's called Salam Restaurant. In my opinion, it's like a hidden... And I waited there, so I know the cook. I know it's a husband and wife, two kids that have owned it since the early 1990s. It's a co-op, and they own the floor, and it's great Syrian, Middle Eastern food, incredible dishes, affordable. You can actually order every single appetizer on the menu as one flat fee, not unreasonably priced, and absolutely delicious.
Is it in the northwest corner there?
It's right across from where Cafe Lou used to be, so it's on the south side on almost at 6th Avenue.
Okay.
On you're on 13th Street.
Okay. And then you have a recently favorite, because that's an all-time favorite.
That's an all-time
favorite. It has to be. You waited there.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of my go-tos. I think recently I've been trying to experiment and try out new places. In my neighborhood, there's just a really fun place to go that's Mexican. It's called Fonda. It just has really good frozen margaritas. Again, bringing it back to like Miami and warm weather just kind of makes me feel like I'm not in New York City in the middle of February. And it's got outdoor space too. I love restaurants with outdoor space.
That's true, especially not in the winter.
Yes, especially not in the winter.
Any recent life changes or personal updates as of late that you'd like to share?
Just having my older daughter has gone through where she used to be adoring and loving, and now she doesn't want a whole lot to do with me. Okay. So
she's rebellious.
Yes, being a dad of an almost teenager has been interesting.
You going to just do any fun activities with her this year?
I try to. I try to surf with them. I try to play tennis with them.
You're a surfer and a jiu-jitsu guy, right?
Yep. Although my wife has made me stop doing jiu-jitsu.
Oh, okay.
So I picked it up at 40 years old. I had two surgeries in the last 5 years, and my wife said, "Hey, this isn't for you." I agreed for the time being.
Surfing is kind of nice.
Surfing's amazing. That's one of my, it's almost like meditating for me. It's a way you just get out there. I do it in Queens and I have a house in Long Island too. And so it's a great escape. I think a lot of people don't realize about New York City is that it's got some of the best waves in the world and you can literally go off of Queens. You can take the A train with your surfboard and get out there. I've done that at 5 a.m. So. Mm.
That's dedication. You're talking about Jacob Riis or
Far Rockaway.
Far Rockaway, yeah. Okay, great. So that kind of goes into the fun fact about yourself. Do you have any other fun facts? I like the fact that you're going to Rockaway at 5 in the morning on the A train with your surfboard, but...
Yeah, not too many fun facts other than that I can think of that aren't too self-deprecating.
That's really good. So let's just go into deep dive questions now because
sure.
You're an expert on all matters relating to estate matters, real estate,
We've done some deals together when it was kind of both, and we had to make sure that everything was going smoothly on the estate side before we can even close. You know, my main question is this right off the bat. Let's just say both parents pass away and it's a co-op and they're both on a stock certificate. And the next of kin would be their son. Let's just say the son is a deadbeat. Failed out of school or failed out of life or not really doing much, kind of struggling, doesn't have a lot of money. That son's not going to qualify for a co-op board, right? What happens in that situation? Can the son still get on the stock and lease? If so, how? What are the legal implications on the son or maybe the daughter? I'm just generalizing. Sorry, it said son. Maybe I should be even here, son or daughter. Deadbeat daughter too, right? That's possible. What are the situations that you've seen there and how does it work out?
So it's actually a good question. And I think it's pretty misunderstood too in terms of co-op ownership and who has what rights. So with your example, it's important that you're using an immediate family member. Because generally speaking,
like a son
or daughter, immediate family members can have different rights. Let me explain exactly.
Please. Yeah.
So when you own the co-op, you have two ownership documents, a stock certificate and a proprietary lease, right?
Yeah.
And your proprietary lease is 95% of the time going to be the same throughout the city, but there are going to be some nuances. There's going to be a paragraph about when a transfer can happen. When the second parent dies, that means that there is no owner on the stock and it has to be probated. So the son may have a right to inherit it and own it. And a lot of beneficiaries and sons and daughters think, okay, that means I get to live in there and do whatever I want with it. Right. And I can sell this. I can sign the listing agreement.
It's my thing. Yes.
It's mine. That they give it to me in the will. Yeah. Well, I can do whatever I want with it. I can have a party tomorrow. You can't.
And you can't because why?
You can't because the co-op's lease supersedes any kind of right you're going to put in a will to occupy it.
Well, this is very important. Co-op's stock and lease supersedes a legal will.
That's correct.
Okay.
So the legal will takes effect on death and says, this person can inherit it. They can even say they own it. But the truth of the matter is the co-op is going to have a right of consent or rejection to that beneficiary. So if it's a friend, if it's a partner, if it's a non-married person, they're going to be treated like any third party. They're going to be held to the same standard as any buyer coming in. A lot of proprietary leases, if it's a spouse or an immediate family member, will have a lesser standard, but still a standard and it not be automatic. So for a son, some proprietary leases will say that the board can't be unreasonable in their consent, which believe it or not, with a third party buyer, they can be unreasonable. They literally legally can be unreasonable.
Yeah.
And let me reiterate that. Like they can be unreasonable. They can't discriminate. Legal to be unreasonable.
It's legal to be difficult.
I say this to people a lot in the probate, they can be unreasonable. They're allowed to be unreasonable because they have the business judgment rule, which allows them to use their reasonable judgment, which may not be reasonable to you or I, but is reasonable to them. So that will give the son the right, if they can financially prove themselves, to pass the board and the board to not be unreasonable, to then get on the stock and lease and own it.
What would be the requirement for the son to be able to go into the board? Does that mean it's a standard board approval as a buyer? You're submitting all of your work history, all of your financials. Is that credit reports, background reports, and all of that?
It depends on the co-op and it depends on what the proprietary lease says, but it's a lesser standard because it's
family member.
It's the family member, and usually it's a specified family member, right?
What's the language of the proprietary lease typically?
Yeah, I think to be really careful and safe, I think every proprietary lease can be a little different. In fact, for coming here, I looked at a couple. One said spouse and parents. Another said spouse, no consent needed, you automatic. Another one said spouse and immediate family members need to show financial ability, whatever that means.
Very vague.
Vague.
Right?
Purposely vague.
It could be, we are a 50-50 LTV building.
Yeah.
You have to submit 50% down.
Yeah.
Quite a high barrier.
That's right.
New York City. And what if the same is imposed to the, I'd say deadbeat son or daughter, but
yeah.
Let's just say even a normal working
individual. Yeah.
100K salary.
Yeah.
Maybe 25 years old.
Yeah.
How are they going to afford a 50?
They're not going to.
They can't.
Right.
So it's very vague in their proprietary lease.
Yes. Exactly.
And again, so what happens if the board rejects? It's still in their will. It's still their, technically, his apartment that he can sign off on, or her daughter, her apartment, they could sign off on it. What are the options if they just can't pass the board?
So this is important. And this is why trusts are important in the co-op context. So the son cannot occupy it, but they still can.
They can't live there.
They can't live there, right. But they can, after they get approval from the surrogates court and get letters testamentary, which is when you have a will or letters of administration, when you have no will. They can get that approval from the court. They can then sign a listing agreement. They can then sign a contract. They can then close and sell and get the proceeds. They just can't occupy it.
They just can't occupy it.
Now, if they had a trust and the trust had an occupancy agreement allowing them to be there, they could day one sign a listing agreement and live there.
Mm-hmm. So repeat that again. If they had a trust and they have an occupancy agreement, but the occupancy agreement supersede the proprietary lease?
Yes. In fact, it specifically does. Like my office is negotiating one right now where someone wants to provide for their partner. The partner had for years her own separate apartment. She wants her partner to be there after her passing and then ultimately go to beneficiaries. And so that occupancy agreement is going to allow someone who's not on the stock to continue living there after the shareholder's death, even though she's not a spouse, not a son, not a parent. And that occupancy agreement will say exactly who can live there.
Does that mean the stock and lease's name has to be in that trust? For example, on the stock certificate, it says the Johnson Family Trust.
This is a great question. And this is a huge, huge mistake that is made countless times in New York City transactions. And this actually doesn't just apply to co-ops, it applies to condos, it applies to houses, it applies to IRA beneficiary designations. So there's a really important distinction. When you create a trust, you create a trust agreement, you sign it, you're very happy. I've taken care of my business. I've done a trust. Guess what? You haven't funded it, meaning you haven't actually, until you've put the stock certificate in the name of the Johnson Trust, until you've actually had it in the name of the trust, it hasn't been funded, and it's not in the trust, and it won't pass according to the trust. So that lack of funding is a huge problem that happens.
What if the co-op board does not allow you to buy in a trust? Is the buyer screwed?
Yes, in a sense, although some co-ops will say a buyer can't buy in a trust, but after you've proven to be a good shareholder, we allow existing long-term shareholders. I've seen that distinction.
That is significantly more reasonable.
Yes.
Significantly.
Yes.
I have looked at probably over 1,000 closing documents for co-ops in my lifetime, and it's very rare that the closings happen in a trust.
That's correct.
So this just comes to my attention that when we've done deals where, unfortunately, residential real estate, my clients have died. Whether it's COVID, natural causes, you've come in and taken over, deal with their parents because their son or daughter died in the apartment. And it seems like none of these case studies where the occupants have died, they're never in a trust.
That's right.
So the financials kind of get a little complicated in that regard. And also the end use of that property gets very, very complicated because the parents can't use it.
That's right.
Or the sons can't use it. The daughters can't use it. Okay. So it's very deep. I know it's very multi-layered there, but I want to say, is it bizarre to you that most co-ops do not allow ownership purchases via family limited partnerships, a trust, LLC, corporation, or an estate? And what do you think that is? And then the second part is, how does that differ from condominiums?
In my opinion, it is a little weird. You know, I at one time owned a co-op and was the president of my co-op board. I grew up in a co-op. So I understand the thinking that they're trying to protect every shareholder. They want to make sure maintenance gets paid. But it's weird to me that they won't allow it provided the safeguards are there, right? So in some ways, when you have a trust, you know more. If there's an occupancy agreement, you know exactly who's living there. If you've got a personal guarantee, which is what almost any co-op that's well represented by a good co-op attorney, the person's going to be personally guaranteeing it. And some will even have maintenance in escrow and things like that. So think that while co-ops may be coming from a good place and trying to protect shareholders, I think they're forgetting about the needs at a death of the shareholders. And I think they're forgetting that with proper co-op attorneys on board, they're in some ways just as protected, if not more protected.
Okay. So going back to the question, should trusts have preferential treatment for buyers to be able to buy in a trust versus S-corps and LLCs? Also, what about, we've also had situations where buyers have asked if they could buy it in a family limited partnership. How does that differ?
So the trust situation is ultimately not that much different than a family limited partnership or an LLC.
So there is a difference.
There's a difference. I mean, the similarity between all of them is that they're great estate planning tools, because what we try to avoid in doing estate planning is having to show up with a new stock and lease or having to re-record a deed. So with an LLC,
A lot of billable hours,
right. But you ultimately try to do the best thing by the client and not have, you know, people may not be around to sign documents. All those vehicles that we're talking about there, limited partnerships, LLCs, et cetera, you can change the membership and you can switch things around without having to re-record a deed or get a new stock and lease. So those are in some ways very like trusts. However, with trusts, usually you're dealing with specific family members and specific people. Limited partnerships get a bit more complicated and many times involve NLCs, investors, or minority people, and it can become then a little bit more complex. So I rarely see them in the co-op context.
Got it. Okay. And then going back to condos, what do you typically see in condominiums when people want to put it into a form of ownership that's outside of their legal name?
So very flexible. 90% of condos, I have no problem with trusts or LLCs. They're very flexible because all they have is a right of first refusal, not a right to say yes or no. The best kind of asset protection is you create an LLC or something just to own that piece of property, right? And you have no other assets tied to it. Now, that's not great from a standpoint of a landlord or a condominium, because then all they can go after is that one LLC, not any of the assets of the person behind that LLC, et cetera. So a couple of times I've seen condos try to hold up sales because it was an empty LLC with a foreign person buying with no assets here. And the only thing the condo could go after was this LLC that just had a bank account for the condo.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, very easy, very flexible. One of the biggest reasons to lean towards a condo would be the flexibility of ownership and transfer.
Okay, I totally agree there. I know you're not a tax lawyer, but we kind of want to get a gist of when, let's say son or daughter.
Okay, son or daughter.
Or a family member.
Okay.
A parent's passed. Both parents passed. Unfortunately, it's their time. The property has appreciated to, let's just say, one of these Flatiron properties, right? They bought it at 10K and now it's worth 10 mil. They never sold it. It gets passed down to their children. What types of tax implications do you see in New York City? What are some of the common maybe misconceptions, if there are any, about the tax implications of inheriting property?
So this is another great one where I have seen people come to me and they've royally screwed this up.
Oh boy.
So one of the things to really understand is that under current law, if you die with property and leave it to someone, so let's use an example of $6 million co-op that was bought for $60,000. Under current law, you inherit that, the taxable basis, meaning what you start from and pay taxes on, is the fair market value at the date of death. So a $60,000 co-op that mom dies with and it's $6 million and son sells for $6.1 million, son is only paying tax on the difference between $6 million and $6.1 million. So if mom in her later years decides, you know what, I'm going to sell this instead of renting it out, mom is going to pay capital gains on the difference between $60,000 and almost $6 million.
Yeah.
Or they gift it or they transfer it during their lifetime, again, losing that what's called stepped up basis at death. So it's very important to understand that there's a huge tax benefit to dying with property and leaving it and not doing sale or transfer during life unless it's necessary.
Right. Unless liquidation is absolutely necessary.
Yeah. Okay. The basic rent and rule of thumb estate planning, highly appreciated property, hold on to it if you can, unless you need
it. You have to get the cash out. What happens if it's the same situation where mom and dad passes away, but they live in Connecticut instead? But the sons and the kids live in New York City. Is it the same federal tax laws? Is it the same applies?
There are federal tax laws in terms of exemptions. Right now, federally, there's almost over $13 million per person. New York is around $6 million per person. After these numbers, you're starting to pay estate taxes. So depending on the value of the place in New York, it certainly would matter. But the other reason for trusts is if you're in Connecticut and you own property in a different state, this is another misconception. If you're in Connecticut and you're what's called domiciled in Connecticut, that means your will has to be done there.
Okay.
So then when you own this other property in New York State, most transfers, you have to get authority in Connecticut or wherever you are, then go to New York surrogate's court, say, I have authority there, give me authority here. It's called an ancillary proceeding. And you get authority for the limited purposes of transferring that co-op, that condo, and then you do a transfer under an ancillary probate. If you had a trust, guess what? None of that. No probate in Connecticut, no probate in New York. So that's another big reason is multi-state ownership is to have a trust.
Have a trust. And the trust, does it have to be in Connecticut or does it matter?
It's more of an estate planning. Wills have to be where you're domiciled. Mm-hmm. Trust, for the most part, really it's following where you are. You can create trusts in different places, but generally the person that's drafting it for you is based in your area and drafting a specific.
It seems like everybody should be buying property in a trust rather than buy it in their own names or an LLC.
Just practically speaking, for people that are out there listening to this, with a strict, tough co-op, we're honestly talking about $5,000, $8,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in legal fees up front.
Oh my goodness.
So it's a lot.
Yeah.
Right? But I often tell people you can pay and it can hurt now or you could pay a lot later.
A lot more later.
And that apartment with, you know, 18 months of unpaid maintenance while we sit in COVID and the surrogates court's backed up and you can't sell it, property might be depreciating, is going to be way more than that $15,000, that $20,000. So sometimes a bit of pain up front with legal fees leads to much less pain down the road.
Got it. So the trust is not something for listeners that you can just set up on like ChatGPT or Rocket Lawyer or...
Yeah. I mean, you can. I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, people come to me all the time with do-it-yourself things. They'll come in with unnotarized documents. Mm-hmm. They'll come in with documents that are meant for a different state. And these things are all about the technicalities.
You talked about probate. My fascination with probate and the whole going through court if one passes away and the family members need to be designated as the executor, executrix. It's just fascinating that it takes 12 months minimum. I think during COVID, maybe 2 years, right?
Easily.
So who's paying the maintenance, the carrying costs, real estate taxes? Who is paying that?
So generally speaking, no one's paying. And
so the building gets screwed if somebody dies.
The building gets screwed. So what the executor can do is they can front the money.
But if they're not designated as an executor yet? Right, because doesn't it take a year to go through probate before an executor is assigned?
So it's actually interesting. If we're actually being technical about it, a person in a will, mm-hmm. they're the executor. They just have to be recognized by the court. Mm-hmm. Reasons they might get turned down, which would be rare, would be that they have a felony. They're just insufficient financially to handle a big financial estate, and there's going to be some big bond required. But generally speaking, if they're up for the job and the lawyer does their job of proving all the things, that it's a valid will, that it was properly notarized and witnessed, that person's going to get appointed. So that executor can front money to prevent waste. So certainly if there's going to be a foreclosure happening, right, that's going to be a time an executor may come in and say, let me pay this and stop a foreclosure from happening. Mm-hmm. And by the way, in a co-op, a foreclosure can happen without any court proceeding because it's personal property, unlike a house or a condo. Technically speaking, assuming the right kind of things went out in the mail and were served on the right people, within 30 days, the co-op can have a private auction. And as long as they sell it for a commercially reasonable price, your co-op is gone.
Interesting.
You can file bankruptcy. You can run into court and try to get a judge to, by order to show cause, to stop that. But nothing's automatic. And so you have to be very careful with co-ops.
For condos, is that the same or how does it differ?
For condos, it differs definitely.
Someone still has to pay the taxes, though.
Someone still has to pay the taxes. Someone still has to pay the bank. But to foreclose, whether it's on a common charge lien or on unpaid mortgages, it depends where you are. In Kings County, on a mortgage, you're looking at 5 years.
Okay.
If you're in Suffolk County, one of the best place for banks, you're probably looking at 1 or 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So realistically, you've got a lot of time on a foreclosure process.
That's great. Let's preface this to our listeners that the majority of the product that we sell are co-ops inherently because 80% of the inventory that you can purchase in New York City are co-op. We don't want to make it seem like you should never buy a co-op because there are very good things about co-ops as well. But there are obviously some legal pitfalls here that Nick is talking about that it really should be considered, taken into consideration. If you are able to afford a condo, would you go the condo route or the co-op route? Because these estate matters can get extremely complicated, especially if there's a risk of certain legal implications, financial implications that these people don't know about. It would be pretty evil for a co-op to go after a shareholder that had unfortunately passed away, even after, let's just say, 30 days.
Very evil. Very.
Have you seen it happen?
No, I haven't. With estates, generally speaking, they will be very forgiving.
They'll let it go.
Good.
Human.
It won't be on you. Yeah.
They're human.
They're human. And they know. It'll go 16, 18 months, maintenance of $60,000, $70,000 accruing. What they want to see is a good faith effort and movement towards the process.
Okay, yeah.
So if the person that is inheriting is not doing anything in probate court, is completely ignoring the managing agent.
Sitting there for 2 years.
Not talking to a listing agent, not talking to the super, then you're going to have problems.
We totally get that. Okay.
Yeah.
Have you watched the show Succession?
I have.
Okay.
Yes.
Say we are in that TV series Succession, and you are the lawyer that does not represent the media companies that the characters own, but let's just say a real estate empire. Succession, but in real estate.
Okay.
How would you advise the three kids in dealing with the main owner's eventual passing, or vice versa? How would you deal with the owner of the real estate that is about to pass to make sure things are kosher after he passes?
there's estate planning and then there's estate planning with an emphasis. You know, when we're talking about assets in, you know, north of 30 million, 40 million, 100 million.
100 million plus.
Yeah. Most of those people do not pay estate taxes. And the reason they don't pay estate taxes is there's very sophisticated planning for the kids where it's not just trust so we can avoid probate. It's not just trust so we can occupy it. It's trust so that under the tax regulations, the ownership is skewed enough that the person that is dying has removed the assets from their bucket. The bucket is high now. It's almost $14 million per person. But for $100 million, you're paying 40% of the overage. So if you have a real estate man that has $100 million in property and has this exemption of 13-something under current law, then over...
$13 million is exemption.
What's that?
Just to clarify, $13 million is exemption?
Oh, yeah, it's almost 14.
Okay.
And that is for U.S. citizens. For foreigners that invest in real estate, it's $60,000. That's a huge thing to know, right? If you're ever working with a foreign buyer.
$60,000?
$60,000.
$13 million.
Yes. So, but for the real estate magnate, anything above that $13 million, if they just don't plan, they don't have a will, they're paying 40% of $87 million to the federal government.
Okay.
Instead of their kids, instead of charities, if you're anywhere close to the estate tax exemption, which in New York is cliff at around $6 million and federally around just under $14 million, you need to do some serious planning. And for the people that are above the federal limits and way above and they want it, yeah, you got to do some really sophisticated planning.
Got it.
And that means putting buildings in LLCs, things called defective grantor trust. There's all kinds of sophisticated planning.
The big real estate drama, family drama that is happening in New York City today, the eldest child is being accused by the other siblings that they hired Newmark to do the appraisal, and the client was in Newmark's ears to make sure that the appraisal comes in lower than market value. And obviously that trades for a lesser value of shares and all of that between the siblings, which is why there's this big fight. Are there things that real estate magnates can do to ensure that these accusations don't happen up front?
So one powerful tool that, you know, depending on the situation, I will put trust or will documents, okay, is you get your benefit, you get your designation, you get what you're coming in the will or the trust. But if you challenge it and you question what everyone's supposed to get, that is lost. So you have something really to lose by challenging what has been set up by the testator or the trustee.
Got it.
That incentivizes no fighting. If you challenge and win, most of those things say, okay, you're entitled. If you challenge and lose, you lose what was coming to you as a beneficiary.
It disincentivizes.
Disincentivizes.
Fighting.
Exactly.
Got it. Let's go back to some of our clients that are normal clients that we represent. In New York City standards, their net worth can be as low as $200,000 to $300,000, all the way up to maybe, let's just say, an average of a couple million bucks. What are they doing wrong today that you know, and what do they need to do?
Your average person, in my opinion, that I meet that's under 50, regardless of their situation, kids, boyfriend, girlfriend that buy together, the majority of them don't have wills and don't do estate planning, right? So that's the biggest mistake. It's not just for the ultra wealthy, right? It's for anyone that has kids, frankly. Do you want a court deciding who's going to be the guardian of your kids and manage your kids' money? If you don't have a will, that could certainly happen. For a couple that's unmarried that buys together and they don't designate a joint tenancy or survivorship and they died, God forbid, in a joint car accident, we're going to have two families fighting over ownership. So there's so many reasons for people that don't think about mortality or under 50 to plan for death, even if it's years off to come. And so right. I would encourage people to do that kind of thing earlier.
I do not have a will.
You do not?
Sure. Yeah. But I did have to, when I set up my brokerage account, they ask who gets the money if someone dies.
Yeah.
They ask you these questions. So this is a very common problem, I think, with maybe 70 to 80% of the people that we represent also. They don't have anything set up. And then again, all the co-op ownership, it just throws another curveball because the co-op ownership makes it that much more difficult to own it in a trust.
That's right.
Or a name of a trust, that is. Do you have maybe one crazy story, something that you can share without disclosing names or addresses, and maybe like a lesson learned from that story?
Sure. I used to do a lot of litigation, and this ties into both real estate and it ties into estate planning. Mom and daughter, very friendly, almost like best friends. Buy a bunch of houses together. Both are on mortgages, both put money in, both go to the open houses and showings and maintain it. They have a fight. Daughter moves out. They co-own maybe 7 houses and 8 pieces of land together. Mom says, you owe nothing. Daughter says, how can that be? Mom says, you were only on the deed as an estate planning tool that you get this at death, and I'm not changing it.
Oh, so they were purchased in trust?
No, they're both on the deed in their own names.
Okay, all right. So that seems weird.
Seems weird.
Okay.
Right? So this is what can happen. This is true with co-ops. Even if you're a boyfriend and girlfriend, those are the difficult situations. You ever have a client that is a boyfriend and girlfriend that's buying together? Make sure they think about what goes on that stock certificate. It's really important to understand that ownership document and what it means, because the default between unmarried people, whether it's a mom and daughter or a boyfriend and girlfriend, it's a rebuttable presumption, but there's a presumption that they're equal co-owners 50-50. So with a mom and daughter, the mom has to the challenge of now saying that was only a gift. You were not supposed to have anything during lifetime. Now, that may be hard for her to prove. Doesn't mean she can't and hasn't held it up for 7 years in court.
7 years.
That means we can't hire you guys to sell it. That means we can't sign a listing agreement.
Nope.
That means we have to go and do what's called partition, which means a forced sale where the referee will literally sell it on the courthouse steps and the referee becomes the deeded owner.
But isn't that more like bankruptcy sale? In that
it's like a bankruptcy. Yeah, and you're going to sell way below what you're going to get from a broker.
Why would the mother or daughter, if they get in the fight, still work together and agree that they should settle our differences and sell them at market rate?
Because when you talk to people who are co-own and have a difference of opinion, sometimes rational thinking goes out the window and emotion kicks in. In this particular situation, the mother would rather let it all crash and see nothing than let her daughter get anything.
What ended up happening with the daughter and the mother?
It's actually in the public record and it's ongoing. Yeah.
It's still going.
Yes.
Okay. Please follow Nick. Put in the show notes. His website, his LinkedIn, his email, his contact information will be on the show notes. Please follow him. Nick is a wealth of knowledge, and I'm pretty sure we only touched the tip of the iceberg of what we talked about today in a 1 hour span. That's not enough time to talk about estate matters, especially when it comes to co-ops and condos and drama in New York and family dynasties and things of that nature. So I really appreciate your time, Nick. You know, we hope to do more business in the future and hopefully not as dramatic as some of these case studies that we...
No, there were some easy ones.
we talked about today. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.